landing zone just west of Pinkville. Something was wrong. Maybe it was the sunlight. Sorcerer felt dazed and half asleep, still dreaming wild dawn dreams. All night, he'd been caught up in pink rivers and pink paddies. Even now, squatting at the rear of the chopper, he couldn't flush away the pink. All that color. It was wrong. The air was wrong. The smells were wrong. And the thin, rosy sunlight, and how the men seemed wrapped inside themselves. Meadlow and Mitchell and Thinbill sat with their eyes closed. Sledge fiddled with his radio. Conti was off in some mental whorehouse. PFC Weatherby kept wiping his M16 with a towel. First the barrel, and then his face, and then the barrel again. Boyce and Maples and Lieutenant Callie sat side by side in the chopper's open doorway, sharing a cigarette, quietly peering down at the cratered fields and paddies. Pure wrongness, Sorcerer knew. He could taste the sunlight. It had a rusty, metallic flavor, like nails on his tongue. For a few seconds, Sorcerer shut his eyes and retreated behind the mirrors in his head, pretending to be elsewhere. But even then, the landscapes kept coming at him fast and lurid. At 7:30, the choppers banked in a long arc and approached the hamlet of Tuan Yen from the southwest. Below, almost straight ahead, white puffs of smoke opened up in the paddies just outside the village. The artillery barrage swept across the fields and into the western fringes of Tuan Yen, cutting through underbrush and bamboo and banana trees, setting fires here and there, skirting northward as the helicopters skimmed in low over the drop zone. The door gunners were now laying down a steady, suppressing fire. They leaned into their big guns, shoulders twitching. The noise made Sorcerer's eyelids go haywire. "Down and dirty!" someone yelled, and the chopper settled into a wide, dry paddy. Mitchell was first off, then Boyce and Conti and Meadlow, then Maples, then Sledge, then Thinbill, and the stubby lieutenant. Sorcerer went last. He jumped into the sunlight, fell flat, found himself alone in the paddy. The others had vanished. There was gunfire all around, a machine gun wind, and the wind seemed to pick him up and blow him from place to place. He couldn't keep his legs beneath him. For a time he lay pinned down by things unnatural, the wind and heat, the wicked sunlight. He would not remember pushing to his feet. Directly ahead, a pair of stately old coconut trees burst into flame. Just inside the village, Sorcerer found a pile of dead goats. He found a pretty girl with her pants down. She was dead, too. She looked at him cross-eyed. Her hair was gone. He found dead dogs, dead chickens. Farther along, he encountered someone's forehead. He found three dead water buffalo. He found a dead monkey. He found ducks pecking at a dead toddler. Events had been channeling this way for a long while. Months of terror. Months of slaughter. And now, in the pale morning sunlight, a kind of meltdown was in progress. Pigs were squealing. The morning air was flaming up toward purple. He watched a young man hobbling up a trail, 1 foot torn away at the ankle. He watched Weatherby shoot 2 little girls in the face. Deeper into the village, in front of a small L-shaped hooch, he came across a GI with a woman's black ponytail flowing from his helmet. The man wiped a hand across his crotch. He gave a little flip to the ponytail and smiled at Sorcerer and blooped an M79 round into the L-shaped hooch. "Blammo!" the man said. He shook his head as if embarrassed. "Yeah, well," he said. Then shrugged and fired off another round and said, "Boom!" At his feet was a wailing infant. A middle-aged woman lay nearby. She was draped across a bundle of straw, not quite dead, shot in the legs and stomach. The woman gazed at the world with indifference. At one point she made an obscure motion with her head, a kind of bow, inexact, after which she rocked herself away. There were dead waterfowl and dead house pets. People were dying loudly inside the L-shaped hooch. Sorcerer uttered meaningless sounds. "No," he said. Then after a second he said, "Please." And then the sunlight sucked him down a trail toward the center of the village, where he found burning hooches and brightly mobile figures engaged in murder. Simpson was killing children. PFC Weatherby was killing whatever he could kill. A row of corpses lay in the pink to purple sunshine along the trail. Teenagers and old women and two babies and a young boy. Most were dead. Some were almost dead. The dead lay very still. The almost dead did twitching things until PFC Weatherby had occasion to reload and make them fully dead. The noise was fierce. No one was dying quietly. There were squeakings and chicken house sounds. "Please," Sorcerer said again. He felt very stupid. 30 meters up the trail, he came across Conti and Meadlow and Rusty Callie. Meadlow and the lieutenant were spraying gunfire into a crowd of villagers. They stood side by side, taking turns. Meadlow was crying. Conti was watching. The lieutenant shouted something and shot down a dozen women and kids, and then reloaded and shot down more, and then reloaded and shot down more, and then reloaded again. The air was hot and wet. "Jeez, come on," the lieutenant said. "Get with it. Move. Light up these fuckers." But Sorcerer was already sprinting away. He ran past a smoking bamboo schoolhouse. Behind him and in front of him, a brisk machine gun wind pressed through Tuan Yen. The wind stirred up a powdery red dust that sparkled in the morning sunshine, and the little village had now gone mostly violet. He found someone stabbing people with a big silver knife. Hutto was shooting corpses. Tsuvas was shooting children. Doherty and Terry were finishing off the wounded. This was not madness, Sorcerer understood. This was sin. He felt it winding through his own arteries, something vile and slippery like heavy black oil in a crankcase. "Stop," he thought. But it wouldn't stop. Someone shot an old farmer and lifted him up and dumped him in a well and tossed in a grenade. Roshevitz shot people in the head. Hudson and Wright took turns on a machine gun. The killing was steady and inclusive. The men took frequent smoke breaks. They ate candy bars and exchanged stories. A period of dark time went by, maybe an hour, maybe more. Then Sorcerer found himself on his hands and knees behind a bamboo fence. A few meters away, in the vicinity of a large wooden turret, 15 or 20 villagers squatted in the morning sunlight. They were chattering among themselves, their faces tight. And then somebody strolled up and made a waving motion and shot them dead. There were flies now, a low, droning buzz that swelled up from somewhere deep inside the village. And then for a while Sorcerer let himself glide away. All he could do was close his eyes and kneel there and wait for whatever was wrong with the world to right itself. At one point it occurred to him that the weight of this day would ultimately prove too much, that sooner or later he would have to lighten the load. He looked at the sky. Later he nodded. And then later still, snagged in the sunlight, he gave himself over to forgetfulness. "Go away," he murmured. He waited a moment, then said it again, firmly, much louder, and the little village began to vanish inside its own rosy glow. Here, he reasoned, was the most majestic trick of all. In the months and years ahead, John Wade would remember Tuan Yen the way chemical nightmares are remembered. Impossible combinations, impossible events, and over time the impossibility itself would become the richest and deepest and most profound memory. This could not have happened. Therefore, it did not. Already he felt better. Tracer rounds corkscrewed through the glare, and people were dying in long, neat rows. The sunlight was in his blood. He would both remember and not remember a fleet human movement off to his left. He would not remember squealing. He would not remember raising his weapon, nor rolling away from the bamboo fence, but he would remember forever how he turned and shut down an old man with a wispy beard and wire glasses and what looked to be a rifle. It was not a rifle. It was a small wooden hoe. The hoe he would always remember. In the ordinary hours after the war, at the breakfast table, or in the babble of some dreary statehouse hearing, John Wade would sometimes look up to see the wooden hoe spinning like a baton in the morning sunlight. He would see the old man shuffling past the bamboo fence, the skinny legs, the erect posture, and the wire glasses, the hoe suddenly sailing up high and doing its quick twinkling spin and coming down uncaught. He would feel only the faintest sense of culpability. The forgetting trick mostly worked. On certain late-night occasions, however, John Wade would remember covering his head and screaming and crawling through a hedgerow and out into a wide paddy where helicopters were ferrying in supplies. The paddy was full of colored smoke, lavenders and yellows. There were loud voices and many explosions, but he couldn't seem to locate anyone. He found a young woman laid open without a chest or lungs. He found dead cattle. All around him there were flies and burning trees and burning hooches. Later, he found himself at the bottom of an irrigation ditch. There were many bodies present, maybe 100. He was caught up in the slime. PFC Weatherby found him there. "Hey, Sorcerer," Weatherby said. The guy started to smile, but Sorcerer shot him anyway. Chapter 14. Hypothesis. What happened, maybe, was that Kathy drowned. Something freakish. A boating accident. Maybe a sandbar. Maybe she was skimming along, moving fast, feeling the cold spray and wind and sunlight, and then came a cracking sound, a quick jolt, and she felt herself being picked up and carried. A moment of incredible lightness, an unburdening, a soaring sensation. And then the lake was all around her, and soon inside her, and maybe in that way Kathy was drowned and gone. The purest speculation, just one possibility out of many, but Kathy might have awakened early that morning. Maybe for a few moments she watched him sleep. It had been a bad night, like so many other nights, and the sockets of John's eyes looked dark and old. At times she barely recognized him. All that rage. It was like some terrible virus that kept multiplying inside him. She wished there was a cure she could offer, or words she could say. But, of course, there was nothing. Maybe she leaned over and kissed him. Maybe she whispered something. It was still dark, almost certainly, when she slipped out of bed. She showered, dried her hair, checked her eyes for new wrinkles, returned to the bedroom, and put on a pair of faded blue jeans and a white cotton sweater. She was careful not to wake him. She hung her bathrobe on its hook near the door, aligned her slippers at the foot of the bed. In her stocking feet, trying for silence, she moved out to the kitchen and went about her morning routine. Orange juice and vitamins, strong black coffee, a bowl of Wheaties, no sugar. She ate slowly, content to be alone, enjoying the stillness all around her. This was her favorite part of the day, the unfolding light, the fragile gleamings and stirrings. After breakfast, she brushed her teeth vigorously, rinsing the brush and leaving it bristles up in the old jelly jar on the bathroom sink. She washed her dishes, wiped the counter. All these were rituals, fixed and solid. And then for 15 minutes over a second cup of coffee, she sat at the kitchen table with her book of crossword puzzles. This, too, was a ritual. She liked to start each day with a sense of accomplishment, solving what could be solved. Outside, the first smoky light had spilled out over the lake, and for a few seconds Kathy gazed without focus out the kitchen window, maybe daydreaming, maybe hoping that today things might finally turn good again. Pack a picnic lunch, go for a swim and lie in the sun, and talk about their lives. which was one of the problems. They never talked anymore. They never communicated. They never made love. They'd tried once, on their second night, but it had been an embarrassment for both of them. And now it seemed they were always guarding their bodies, always careful, touching only for comfort and closeness. What they needed, she thought, was to be honest. Talk about everything they'd never talked about. Trust and love and hurt. Their truest feelings. Get him to open up. And then, if things went well, if she could find the nerve, maybe then she'd confide her own big secret. Just blurt it out. Tell him she was glad it was over. A relief, she'd say. No more elections. All that was finished. Now she could confess to how much she'd always hated it. The polls and cameras and crowds. Real hate, she'd say. She hated the speeches and petty conspiracies and fake smiles and greedy old Pauls with their Velcro votes and greasy hands. She hated the stink of cigarettes and betrayal. There were times, she'd tell him, when the hating made her stomach hurt. It was like a rock inside her, a huge, heavy rock. And she'd tell him that. Maybe she'd break down. Maybe she'd cry. Probably not. For sure, though, she would be clear about how much she hated tying her self-esteem to the whims of idiots. And the public eye. How it made her feel exposed and naked. How she couldn't tolerate another convention hall, or another baked bean dinner, or another soggy paper plate. Hate, she'd say. Deep, thick, honest hate. She would present a long, detailed list of the things she hated. And at the end, she'd tell him that what she despised more than anything was what politics had done to their lives. How it had taken away everything she most wanted. Ordinary peace. A decent house. A baby to love. To say these things might be difficult. It had to be. But she wouldn't hold back. She'd tell him how the landslide had come as a soft, warm rush. A release. Like carrying around an enormous weight for years and years, and then suddenly putting it down and feeling an incredible new lightness flow into her chest and stomach. Glad, she'd say. She couldn't help it. It was all over and she was glad. Kathy closed her eyes. Don't cry, she thought. Then she said it aloud. You jerk, just don't. She sighed and went to the stove, refilled her coffee cup, and stood motionless for a time before returning to the crossword puzzle. It was just after 6 o'clock. Flakes of speckled light filled the kitchen. Well, that's better, she said. And then for 5 or 10 minutes she sat filling in the grid of squares effortlessly, almost without thought, as if the puzzle were solving itself. She felt calm and alert. A locking sensation. Things in balance. And so, maybe then, gradually at first, Kathy became attuned to a curious new odor in the air. A foul tartness, like spoiled fruit. The smell had been there all along, in her coffee and orange juice, but now it seemed to condense into something solid. Maybe at first she ignored it. Maybe she frowned and went back to the puzzle. Or maybe, instead, she put down her pencil and got up to check the refrigerator and garbage pail. She would have tested the air again, maybe squinting, maybe not, then quietly followed her nose out to the living room. At that point, things would have accelerated. She would have said something, a question probably, then reached out to touch one of the scalded plants. She would have remembered the tea kettle wailing in the night and John's voice. After a second, a kind of understanding would have become manifest. Something must have stirred inside her. Not panic, just the need to breathe. Speed seemed essential. Move and keep moving. She left her book of crossword puzzles folded open on the kitchen counter. She did not pause for a jacket or to leave a note. She was outside before telling herself to go. Half-trotting, not thinking at all, she hurried down the slope to the boathouse and opened up the double doors and dragged the little aluminum boat out into shallow water, letting it fishtail there while she went back for the engine. The old Evinrude was heavy, but she managed to lock it in. She loaded the oars and gas can and life vest, then turned to close the boathouse doors. The right panel hung loose at its upper hinge, partly jammed. Kathy muscled it with a shoulder, leaning in hard, but the panel was stuck solid. She shook her head and waded out to the boat and hopped in. Maybe then, just for an instant, she gave an irritated glance back at the jammed door. Maybe she forgot to put on the life vest. A chain of events was established. All the rest had to follow. She used the oars to pull out into the deep water beyond the dock. Pausing there, she worked the choke and yanked hard on the starter cord. And when the engine caught, she gave the throttle a quarter turn and swung the boat north toward Angle Inlet. 100 yards out, she gave it more power. Fleetingly, perhaps, Kathy noticed the life vest under the front seat, but she did not stop to put it on. Her mind was elsewhere. Just go, she thought. She leaned forward and concentrated on speed. And so what must have happened was that Kathy took the boat along the curving shoreline, past the Birchwood Resort and Brush Island. She was at full throttle. The little boat seemed to pick itself up at the bow, the breeze stiffening to a wind, and for 10 or 15 minutes, Kathy watched the great pine forests sweep by in liquid greens and yellows. The speed felt good to her, the wind and the sunlight, the cold spray against her skin. Maybe she was daydreaming. Maybe she shut her eyes for a moment and tried to tell herself that things might still end happily. Even now it was possible. 38 years old, which wasn't so bad, and with luck she could still have the child she wanted, and a house, and a big garden out back with lilacs and a white bird bath. All they needed was to be open with each other. Tell the truth. Later she thought she'd make herself do it. No evasions. Tell him straight out about Harmon. And then recite a list of all the things she resented. Politics, for sure. But also the manipulation and secrecy and self-pity and paranoia. Tell him it had to end. Tell him she knew about the spying. Years ago she'd known. And she simply couldn't bear it any longer. She'd be blunt with him. Not accusing. Just telling. All those years, she'd say, like a disease. But now everything was different. They were free. They could start over and do things right. And make their marriage fresh and good. She'd tell him that. Yes, she would. Which was all she'd ever wanted. Just to be happy. Kathy nodded to herself and swung the boat west into the channel off Magnuson's Island. Maybe it happened there. Or maybe a mile ahead, where the channel narrowed. She would have been gazing out on the expanses of pine and blue water, the boat bouncing hard against the whitecaps, and maybe for a few seconds she leaned back and gave herself over to sun and speed. Maybe she never saw the sandbar. Maybe she was imagining how their lives might still be good, how things could change, how they would carry their blankets to the porch and lie in the fog and just talk and talk. There was a shiver at the bottom of the boat, a snapping sound, and for an instant she was free of everything. She was light and high. She was soaring through the glassy roof of the world and breaking out into another. And then the lake was all around her, and soon inside her. And maybe in that way, Kathy drowned and was gone. Chapter 15. What the Questions Were. County Sheriff Art Lux flew in from Baudette at first light on the morning of September 20th. By 7 a.m., he had set up a makeshift headquarters in the work bay at Pearson's Texaco Station. Within an hour, the first bulletins had been issued over Marine Band radio, and by 8:30, more than a dozen search boats were out on the lake. It was just after 9 when Lux and Vinnie Pearson pulled up outside Wade's cottage, in an old Willie's Jeep. Claude Rasmussen showed them in. They removed their hats, shook hands with Wade, took seats in the living room while Claude and Ruth went out to the kitchen to make coffee. For John Wade, who sat stiffly on the couch, the physical world seemed flimsy and poorly made. He'd slept only in snatches, an hour at most. The fatigue was doing tricks with his vision. He went down inside himself briefly, just gliding, and when he surfaced, the sheriff was saying something about the need to stay patient. Wade nodded.
"Which means no news?"
"Not yet. Not for a while." Lux opened a small spiral notebook. His eyes were pale blue and sympathetic.
"Thing is, sir, that's a big piece of lake out there. It'll take time."
He hesitated.
"Right now, if you don't mind, we've got a few quick questions, provided you feel up to it."
"Whatever helps," Wade said. Lux smiled and balanced the notebook on his knee. He was a short, gaunt man in his late 50s, tanned and windburnt, dressed in gray trousers and a soiled gray shirt. More like a dairy farmer, Wade thought, than an officer of the law. The badge on his shirt looked like a toy. After a moment, the man slipped on a pair of half-moon reading glasses.
"Just so you know," he said, "we've already got 12 boats out. Plenty more to come. The provincial police up in Kenora, they'll be sending out their own patrol units, which helps a lot. By noon, we'll have a couple spotter planes. Probably more later in the day. Everything's coordinated through my office. That's standard." He smiled again. "So we've got the buttons punched. Border patrol, state police, all kinds of help."
Wade tried to keep his eyes level. He felt like an actor.
"One thing you should keep in mind," Lux said. "A case like this, it's not all that unusual. We run into it 6-7 times a year. Lost hunters, lost fishermen. Somehow things turn out happy, most often."
Lux glanced over at Vinnie Pearson, who sat quietly to the side, his eyes half shut.
"Almost always. Isn't that right, Vin?"
Pearson made an impatient motion with his hand.
"Sure, I guess so. Ask the man why he never..."
"Relax. One thing at a time."
The sheriff adjusted his glasses, flattened the notebook against his knee.
"Now, sir, we've got the basic story from Mr. Rasmussen, the bare bones, so to speak, but I figure it's best to hear it straight from you. Helps us sort things out."
His eyes went warm with concern.
"If you don't feel up to it, we can always try later."
"Now's fine," Wade said.
"Mind if I write stuff down?"
Wade shook his head. Out in the kitchen, Claude and Ruth Rasmussen were doing something with cups and saucers, their voices fading in and out, and again he had the slippery sensation of a dream. The sheriff clicked open a ballpoint pen.
"First thing, before I forget, you don't have a picture handy. Your wife, I mean."
"For what? She's not..."
"No particular reason, just in case."
"In case she's damp," Vinnie Pearson said. "In case the lady turns up wet."
"For Christ's sakes, Vinnie."
"The guy asked."
Wade turned and looked into Pearson's eyes, locking on. And for an instant, something important seemed to pass between them. An acknowledgement of certain possibilities. Wade nodded at him and pulled a small photograph from his wallet. The snapshot was nearly 4 years old, cracked and grainy, but the sheriff studied it with appreciation.
"Gorgeous," he said. "Very pretty. And what about the vitals, sir? Weight, height, all that?"
"You've got the photo there. 5'6", 118 pounds. She'll be 39 in February."
"Identifying marks, scars, or anything?"
"No."
"Medical trouble?"
"No."
The sheriff looked at the snapshot again, slipped it into his breast pocket, and carefully buttoned the flap.
"Now, what we should do," he said, "we should get a handle on the basic chronology. How things happened, more or less."
He gave Vinnie Pearson a cautionary glance.
"Your wife apparently took off sometime yesterday?"
"That's right."
"Yesterday morning?"
"Right."
"And what time would that be?"
"I don't know," Wade said.
Early, I suppose. She was gone when I got up.
Which was when?
Sorry?
When you woke up, sir. The time?
I just told you. I'm not sure. Maybe 11, maybe noon.
You're a late sleeper, then?
Not usually, Wade said. It's a vacation.
The sheriff nodded pleasantly.
Well, sure, I should have figured that. Terrific vacation country.
He took a moment to consider this.
So, if I understand right, your wife could have still been here up until noon or so.
Yesterday's noon.
She could have.
And the last time you actually saw her?
Wade thought about it. Recent events seemed fluid and insubstantial.
A little after midnight, he said. I got up at one point, made myself some tea. She was still here.
Asleep?
Sure. Asleep.
Nothing unusual?
Not at all.
All right, then. But just so I'm clear, that gives us a 12-hour time frame, midnight to noon.
Which is when she would have taken off?
Yes, I suppose so.
And you didn't see...
I didn't see anything, Wade said sharply. I woke up, she was gone. It's that simple.
All this was yesterday?
Right. Yesterday.
Lux took notes in a slow, painstaking hand, underlining phrases here and there. He looked up.
Good. We're getting somewhere. And when did you first decide there might be a problem? Things out of the ordinary.
I'm not sure. Pretty quick, I guess.
Quick?
Well, yes, sort of.
Wade was conscious of his own voice, the tone and language.
I mean, it bothered me right away, but I didn't think, you know, I didn't think it was anything serious. She could have been anywhere, out for a hike.
Your wife's a hiker?
Sometimes.
So you waited around?
Yes.
Nothing else?
Nothing.
Vinnie Pearson grunted under his breath.
Waited, he said,
then took out a fingernail clipper and went to work peeling the grime from under a thumbnail. The man's skin had a smooth, almost colorless quality, pallid and sickly. Not an albino, Wade decided, but close enough. Like a huge white fetus. Wade made himself look away.
So you waited, Lux said. How long?
Quite a while, I guess. All day.
Doing what?
Just things. Housework, cleaning up. I can't see how it matters.
Oh, hell, it probably doesn't.
Except you never know. It's a funny world. Sometimes a stupid little detail can jump up and wiggle its ass and turn awful damn smart.
The sheriff looked down at his notepad.
Anyhow, I guess you finally decided there was a problem.
Wade nodded.
It got dark. She wasn't back.
So you went looking?
Yes.
We're talking when? Pitch dark?
Not at first. Must have been around dusk, sometime after 7. I took a quick walk up the road, hoped I'd stumble into her. It was all I could think of. Then I walked on back and kept waiting.
Just waited?
Naturally.
What else?
Lux smiled politely.
Maybe you needed to relax. Knocked back a drink or two. Nerves and all.
Maybe.
So what?
Nothing.
The man's smile brightened.
Reason I ask, Mr. Rasmussen says you seemed a wee bit tipsy. Later on that night, I mean.
Oh, Christ.
He's mistaken, then?
No, I had a couple.
Wade felt something sour rise up in his throat, a faint cabbage taste.
Kathy's lost out there, stranded probably, and we sit here talking about how many drinks I had.
Which was how many?
The number?
Numbers help.
5 or 6, Wade said.
Not enough.
Vinnie Pearson looked up from his fingernail clipper.
The boat, he said. Ask how come he never once looked to see if... Vin, clam up.
But the man never...
Just ease off. Lux said, and turned toward Wade with an amused little grin.
No offense, that's Vinny's way. Swedish blood. What he's driving at, he's wondering why this whole time, while you're waiting for your wife, why you apparently didn't think to check out the boathouse. Most people, they'd say it's a logical place to start.
No reason, Wade said. It didn't occur to me. Not until later.
At what point was that?
Late? Midnight or so?
Which is when you finally went for help? After you found the boat was gone?
That's right.
12 hours after you first missed her?
Correct.
Lux studied his notepad, the smile sliding away. He seemed displeased with his own handwriting.
Well, see, here's the thing, he said. This boat business doesn't quite figure. The whole problem with noise, for instance. An outboard kicks in, it's something you'd hear.
Not necessarily. I was asleep.
Lux nodded thoughtfully.
I understand that. But those old Evinrudes, they make one bitch of a racket. Wake up the dead, so to speak.
He paused and frowned.
Maybe you wear earplugs?
I don't.
A deep sleeper, then?
Vinnie Pearson chuckled and said, Amazing deep. The air in the room had a tightly packed feel, dense and brittle. It was a welcome distraction when Ruth Rasmussen walked in with a pot of coffee and a large plate of muffins. She gave Wade an encouraging smile, filled their cups, and turned back to the kitchen. For a moment, Wade felt himself tumbling through a crack in reality. Kathy's scent filled the cottage, a mix of perfumes and lotions. He could sense her passage through the air, the draw of her body.
Mr. Wade?
Sorry, I wasn't...
No sweat. What I was wondering, sir, it's one of those questions I hate to ask.
The sheriff tested another smile.
You and your wife. There wasn't any trouble.
I don't follow.
Domestic problems. Disagreements or whatnot?
No.
Any stresses?
Well, come on, you read the papers, don't you?
Wade felt his face heat up.
Christ, yes, there was stress.
The primary?
The primary.
Lux nodded.
Hard thing to deal with, I imagine. Losing like that, it can't be fun. And the Vietnam mess, too. TV and newspapers, the media boys. I guess you could say they gave you a pretty firm going over. Made for some rough sledding, I bet.
We were handling it, Wade said.
Even so, not one of your polite elections.
Lux paused.
Vinny here. He's another nom type. Marines.
Pearson frowned without looking up.
Didn't kill no babies.
Wonderful, Wade said. Swell for you.
Yeah, man. Swell.
So anyway, the sheriff said, I figured there had to be some bad feeling. Tension or whatever.
I don't get the point.
No exact point, Lux said. Background.
Vinnie Pearson made a light scoffing noise.
Forget background. Ask about what Myra told us. Vin, I wish to fucking heaven you'd please shut up. So ask.
Almost invisibly, the two men exchanged glances. Then the sheriff's eyes swept across the living room floor.
The girl down at the mini-mart, Myra Shaw, you might remember her, chubby thing, about 18.
She ain't chubby, Vinnie Pearson said. She's my cousin. She's hog fat.
Right. So, this girl says you and your wife stopped in the other day, had a little dispute at the counter. Pretty warm discussion, she says.
Wade shook his head. It was nothing.
You're saying it didn't happen?
No, I'm saying it's ridiculous. Couple of words, maybe. It barely lasted a minute.
Wade pushed to his feet and crossed over to the living room window. A dazzling autumn day, almost too bright, and it was hard to fit the sunlight with what was happening inside him.
There was no fight, he said quietly. A disagreement, that's all it was.
I understand completely.
You make it sound.
Lux wagged his head.
That wasn't my intention. You say it's nothing, it's nothing.
Again, there was sympathy in his eyes. He leaned back and crossed his legs.
All I meant was the strain and so on. It might explain your wife's state of mind. Maybe she needed a breather, just went off by herself for a while.
Went where? Wade said.
There's the question. She doesn't have friends in the area?
None.
Relatives?
Not here. A sister down in Minneapolis.
The sheriff's smile returned. Well, hey, it's worth a try. Get on the phone. See if your wife's been in touch with...
I didn't catch the name.
The sister.
Pat Patricia Hood.
That's a married name?
Yes.
Divorced.
And no other family to alert?
Wade shook his head.
No one close. Both parents are dead.
What I'd suggest then, Lux said, I recommend you contact anybody you can think of, acquaintances and so on. What happens sometimes, people get this hankering to take off. Bang, they're gone. Then after a week or two, they'll show up again. I've seen it happen.
He removed his glasses and looked up.
She ever run off before, sir?
Not like this.
Like what?
Wade felt a sudden deep fatigue. There were matters he did not want to discuss.
Like nothing. Now and then she'd pop away for a while. A few hours at most.
Nobody else in the picture?
Sorry?
Another man.
Not a chance, Wade said.
You sound positive.
I am. I'm positive.
Briefly, the image of a dentist came to mind.
Forget it.
All right, sure. Will do.
The sheriff sighed and glanced down at his wristwatch.
One last item. Mr. Rasmussen says there was a problem with your phone last night. Apparently you had some trouble locating it.
Is that illegal?
No, sir. Except it was under the sink, I believe, wrapped in a dish towel.
Wade's mouth filled with the sour cabbage taste. His own breathing seemed unfamiliar.
Well, look, it's just one of those things people do, like a symbol or something. The telephone, it hooks up with the outside world, all the crap out there, the election. I just unplugged the thing and put it away and forgot about it. A symbol, you know?
Symbol, Lux said.
I'll write that down.
Do that.
And the houseplants? Those were symbols, too?
There was a short silence. Vinnie Pearson laughed.
No, I didn't.
Wade stopped himself.
It's not all that complicated. Kathy's out there. Everything else is pure bullshit.
A small muscle moved at Lux's jaw.
Bullshit, he murmured.
He closed his notebook, stood up, made a motion at Vinnie Pearson. His eyes shifted toward the window.
Mr. Wade, you're an important guy. Politics and all that. It's way out of my league, so you'll have to be tolerant. I'm just a hayseed cop. Vinny here, he's worse. Pumps gas for a living. Pulls in some part-time deputy pay. Couple of rubes, for sure. But I'll tell you what, we'll do our best to find the lady. Drain the lake if we have to. Bulldoze those woods. Pry up the floorboards.
He smiled generously.
That's not bullshit, sir. That's a guarantee in gold.
The two men put on their hats and walked to the door.
Give it a few hours, Lux said. I'll be in touch. Don't forget those phone calls.
When they were gone, Wade stood for a few minutes at the living room window. What he needed was sleep. Something kept revolving behind his eyes, a shiny black stone. He could feel the weight in his forehead. It required some concentration to pick up the coffee cups and carry them out to the kitchen. Claude sat on a stool at the counter. Ruth was cracking eggs over a fry pan.
3 minutes, she said, and we'll shovel this into your stomach.
She used a wrist to sweep back her hair.
How'd it go out there?
Wade put the cups in the sink. He wasn't sure what to do with himself.
The fact of Kathy's absence would not settle inside him. It had no substance.
"I say, how'd things go?"
He looked at the big iron tea kettle. "Fine, I guess. Except for the part about my being a drunk." Claude laughed.
"Yeah?"
"A lot of other crap, too."
"Well, geez."
The old man grinned and tilted back on his stool. "Tack's not my number one specialty, but I didn't say drunk. I said you seemed a little juiced up, and that's the plain nuts of it. Nobody blames you."
"Terrific."
"They don't."
"What about Pearson? The guy didn't seem..." Ruth looked up from the fry pan.
"Vinny's just Vinny. Few more hours, I bet Kathy'll come ambling right through that kitchen door. Then we'll all get looped."
She slid the eggs onto a plate, dropped on a muffin, brought the plate over to the table.
"Eat," she said.
"Then hit the sack." The eggs helped. When he was finished, Wade tried calling Kathy's sister in Minneapolis. There was no answer. And after a second, he nodded at Ruth and moved unsteadily down the hallway to the bedroom. Sleep was impossible. The fatigue had hardened inside that small black stone behind his eyes. His knees and elbows felt full of gravel. He lay face up on the bed, eyes open, surveying his own state of being. The inner biology seemed impaired. Sparks of silvery white light jumped across the ceiling, and at the top of his head he noticed a sharp tingling voltage, an irregular current, as if electrodes had been implanted just under his scalp. Sorrow was also a problem. He couldn't feel much, just a shadowy uneasiness about his own conduct or misconduct. The interrogation bothered him. Important lines of inquiry, he realized, had not been pursued. Mental health for one, memory for another. Even now it was hard to come up with a neat chronology of those last hours together. The images did not connect. The darkness, the tea kettle, the way he'd glided from spot to spot, as if gravity were no longer a factor. He remembered the sound of mice beneath the porch. He remembered the rich forest smells and the fog, and the curious motion Kathy sometimes made with her fingers, a slight fluttering, as if to dispel all the things that were wrong in their lives. Other things, though, he remembered only dimly. Getting out of bed that night. It had been late, that much he knew. But the wee hour glide lifted him above ordinary time. He remembered the steam, the amps under his skin. He remembered a savage buzzing sound. "Kill Jesus," he was saying. He couldn't stop. And so he boiled a big green geranium near the fireplace, then a dwarf cactus, then several others he couldn't name. He was wearing undershorts. He remembered that. The night smelled of rot. He remembered refilling the tea kettle, waiting for the water to boil, moving to the bedroom. His hands had no relation to his wrists. The mental scaffolding was gone. All the dreams for himself, all the fine illusions and ambitions. The world was electricity. He remembered watching Kathy sleep, admiring the tan at her neck and shoulders, the little wrinkles at her eyes, how, in the dim light, she seemed to be smiling at something, or half-smiling, a thumb curled alongside her nose. At one point a great tenderness had seized him. Like a radio signal from another universe, it made his bowels go slack. It sucked his breath away. A high, shrill command to comfort and protect. Love, he thought. He remembered the weight of the tea kettle. He remembered puffs of steam in the dark. A strange flapping sound, like wings, then a deep buzzing. And then later, he'd found himself waist-deep in the lake. Naked now, and he felt the mushy bottom between his toes. He was examining the stars, hot white stars, in a black sky. These were not memories. These were sub-memories, images from a place beneath the waking world, deeper than dream, a place where logic dissolved. It was beyond remembering. It was knowing. The steady lap of waves against his chest, how cold he was, and how eventually he let himself go under. Not a dive, just sinking. And how his mouth filled with the taste of fish and algae. How his legs scraped against something sharp. A terrible heaviness pressing through his lungs and arms. And how he was finally caught up in layers of forgetfulness. Later on, he sat trembling on the dock. He was naked. He was watching the stars. Absurd, Wade thought. He folded a pillow under his head and lay there inspecting the possibilities. When he awakened, it was nearly dark, the trees webbed in gauzy purples. The clock on the nightstand showed 5:56. Wade dressed, washed his face, and moved out to the living room.
"Sleeping Beauty," Claude said.
The old man sat playing solitaire at a card table in front of the stone fireplace. Even with a fire burning, the cottage seemed cold and drafty.
"Nothing yet, so don't ask," Claude said. "Your friend Lux checked in an hour ago. He's got extra boats lined up for tomorrow. Right now, we just hang tight."
The old man shuffled the cards and dealt himself a new game.
"Ruth and me, we'll sack out in the spare bedroom. No sense stewing in your own juices."
"It's not necessary."
"Maybe not, but still."
Wade shrugged.
"So, you don't have me on trial?"
"For what?"
"Oh, please, don't be coy."
The old man looked up and laughed.
"Vinny spooked you, didn't he? The guy's made that way. Show him a full moon, he'll talk about the dark side."
"Then you don't think?"
"Hell no, I don't. And not Ruth either. Except it might help to start acting like a husband. Some normal concern, it'll look real sweet to people."
The evening passed quietly. After supper, Wade took a short walk along the shore, then showered and shaved, then fixed a pair of vodka tonics and carried them out to the porch. The dock and boathouse were already wrapped in fog. He leaned back against the stoop and worked on the drinks for almost an hour, listening to the woods, letting the small black stone revolve behind his eyes. Long ago, as a kid, he'd learned the secret of making his mind into a blackboard. Erase the bad stuff. Draw in pretty new pictures. Around 9 o'clock, he put in another call to Kathy's sister. He tried several more times, on the hour, but didn't reach her until nearly midnight. It was a difficult conversation. They had a history between them, distance and distrust. Her voice seemed blurry, almost deformed, as if she were holding a handkerchief over the mouthpiece. 20 minutes ago, I turned on the TV. There was a crackling on the line. What happened? I'm not sure. She took a boat out. That's all anybody knows. God! Again there was static, a warped sound. They spoke for another 5 minutes, mostly questions and answers, both of them careful to keep things civil. She hadn't heard from Kathy since the night of the primary. She couldn't imagine anything except the obvious, an accident of some sort. Her voice broke, and for a moment there was silence. "Look, I've already packed," she said. "I'll be there tomorrow. Early, I hope."
"I'm not sure that's tomorrow," she said.
Chapter 16. Evidence. Question. How do you evacuate someone with a hand grenade? Answer. I don't have any idea, sir. Why did you make that statement? It was a figure of speech, sir. What did you mean when you said it? I meant only that the only means I could evacuate the people would be a hand grenade, and that isn't exactly evacuating somebody. William Calley, court-martial testimony. Songmi Village is located approximately 9 kilometers northeast of Kwangyai City and fronts on the South China Sea. In March 1968, the village was composed of 4 hamlets. Tu Kung, Mi Lai, Mi-Ke, and Ko-Lui, each of which contained several sub-hamlets. The Vietnamese knew many of these sub-hamlets by names different from those indicated on U.S. topographic maps of the area. For example, the sub-hamlet identified on the topographic map as My Lai is actually named Tuan Yen, the Peers Commission. Question. What did you do?
Answer. I held my M16 on them.
Why?
Because they might attack.
They were children and babies?
Yes.
And they might attack? Children and babies.
They might have had a fully loaded grenade on them. The mothers might have thrown them at us.
Babies?
Yes.
Were the babies in their mother's arms?
I guess so.
And the babies moved to attack?
I expected at any moment they were about to make a counterbalance.
Paul Meadlow, court-martial testimony. I raised him up to be a good boy, and I did everything I could. They come along and took him to the service. He fought for his country, and look what they done to him. Made a murderer out of him to start with.
Mrs. Myrtle Meadlow, mother of Paul Meadlow.
There is a line that a man dare not cross, deeds he dare not commit, regardless of orders and the hopelessness of the situation, for such deeds would destroy something in him that he values more than life itself. J. Glenn Gray, The Warriors.
John had his own way of handling it all. It destroyed him, you could say. But maybe, in a lot of ways, he was already destroyed.
Anthony L. Tony Carbo.
I am struck by how little of these events I can or even wish to remember.
Colonel William V. Wilson, U.S. Army Investigator.
Look, I don't remember. It was 3 years ago.
Ronald Grashesic, court-martial testimony.
Question. Did you ever tell any officer about what you'd seen?
Answer.
I can't specifically recall.
Ronald Haberl, court-martial testimony.
Question. How many people were in the ditch?
Answer.
I don't know, sir.
Over how large an area were they in the ditch?
I don't know, sir.
Could you give us an estimate as to how many people were in the ditch?
No, sir.
William Calley, court-martial testimony.
Question. What happened then?
Answer.
He, Lieutenant Calley, started shoving them off and shooting them in the ravine.
How many times did he shoot?
I can't remember.
Paul Meadlow, court-martial testimony.
All I remember now is flies and the stink. Some of the guys made these gas masks, dunked their T-shirts in mosquito juice and Kool-Aid. That helped a little, but it didn't help with the flies. I can't stop dreaming about them. You think I'm crazy?
Richard Thinbill.
The ordinary response to atrocities is to banish them from consciousness.
Judith Herman, Trauma and Recovery.
John really suffered during the campaign. Those terrible things people said. It wasn't right. I don't believe a word.
Eleanor K. Wade.
Question. Did you see any dead Vietnamese in the village?
Answer.
Yes, sir.
How many?
Most of them. All over.
Gene Oliver, court-martial testimony.
Persons taking no active part in the hostilities, including members of armed forces who have laid down their arms and those placed hors de combat by sickness, wounds, detention, or any other cause, shall in all circumstances be treated humanely.
The Geneva Conventions on the Laws of War.
Question.
Can you describe what you saw?
Answer.
There was a large mound of dead Vietnamese in the ditch.
Can you estimate how many?
It's hard to say. I'd say 40 to 50.
Can you describe the ditch?
It was 7 to 10 feet deep, maybe 10 to 15 feet across. The bodies were all across it. There was one group in the middle and more on the sides. The bodies were on top of each other.
Richard Pendleton, court-martial testimony.
Question. How did you know they were dead?
Answer. They weren't moving. There was a lot of blood coming from all over them. They were in piles and scattered. There were very old people, very young people, and mothers. Blood was coming from everywhere. Everything was all blood.
Charles Hall.